Hey, it's Amiel. It's been 6 months since the massacres of October 7th, which began the most recent war between Israel and Hamas. There is misery and suffering in Gaza and Israel. There is trauma and loss in Gaza and Israel. People everywhere have been debating, agonizing, and in far too many cases, spewing venom about this crisis. I assume that most of you listening have followed this closely and have heard many different perspectives. Today's episode will not be the only time we discuss this topic. I have at least a couple more planned for this season. On today's episode, you'll hear the story of someone whose perspective of this conflict has shifted significantly over time. You're listening to How My View Grew, the show that dives deep into humanity's challenges by looking at big thinkers who have changed their minds. This week, we hear from someone who has spent decades devoted to nonviolence, who has built a career around this and done so with very positive results in many different settings, from corporate America to Israel and the Palestinian territories to the American Jewish community. Her name is Rachel Aaron Kalish. As you hear in her story and in her voice, this is a human being who brings harmony and calm wherever she goes. And yet, the story you will hear is of someone who also, through a couple of wrenchingly painful experiences, began to ask herself, is nonviolence really the best and only approach in every situation? Or might there be times in the world when force is necessary to save lives and reduce suffering? The latest war between Israel and Hamas is an important part of Rachel's story, yet it is only part of the story. And the story doesn't even start there. And there are two things I want to make crystal clear at the outset. Rachel Aaron does not talk about how she assesses the specific response that the Israeli government makes to October 7th, nor does she address the very complex questions around the limits of force, like how much force is justified in a situation like this? What is too much? And how do you answer these questions in the complex and harrowing situation in Israel and Gaza? So, here's my invitation to you. If you're tempted to listen to Rachel Aaron's story simply by asking yourself, so, is she for or against what Israel has done the last 6 months? Is she for or against what Netanyahu's Israeli coalition has chosen to do? If you're asking those questions, you will not find an easy answer, because that's not what this is about. Instead, here's my encouragement to you. I encourage you to stay with Rachel Aaron in the question that she wrestles with. Is nonviolence always the best approach to conflict? Or might there sometimes be exceptions? Now, you might also be wondering, where do I, Amiel, stand on this war? It's a very reasonable question. Yes, I do have a lot to say, and this episode isn't the place to say it. If you're interested, I invite you to have a look at what I've written over the past 6 months on my Medium page. Let me give you a taste. In early November, I wrote a piece called How Best to Restore Israel's Security and Save Innocent Lives. Notice the two halves of that. Restore security, save lives. In it, I argued that Israel had a right and duty to defend itself after the atrocities of October 7th, and I advocated for a military response, one that is very different from the approach that Israel has taken. A month later, I published a second essay on Medium called On Israel and Gaza, I Am For Jews, as in the number four, although people asked me if I was for FOR Jews, and I said, yeah, that too. And in that piece, I described the deep inner tearing that was happening within me since October 7th, and how this actually might provide an opportunity for me and perhaps others to grow. Quite a few readers, especially American Jews, wrote back to tell me how much they appreciated this piece, because it captured the tensions that were tearing away at them, and also their aspirations to expand. I went on to write a few other essays, including one called Seven Ideas About Israel-Gaza That Can't Survive Reality, which created one heck of a stir. Anyhow, if you want to know how I've been thinking about the war, have a look at the show notes, and you'll see links to these essays and others I've written since October 7th. For now, let's go back to Rachel Aaron, whose story we start when she was very young.
I remember being a very young kid and looking around and watching people in conflict and thinking, this is all wrong. This is just not, something's off here. And I felt like I always knew another way.
This interest continued when she started her career working with corporations.
First of all, I was hired as trainers or OD or HR professionals in various settings. So I would see all kinds of conflicts coming up, and I would just pull groups together and start creating interventions long before there was really a field of mediation or conflict resolution. I just started doing it, and it was really effective. It was incredible. I mean, there would be like teams that were really upset with their manager, and I would bring them into the room, listen to them, bring their manager in, start facilitating with their manager. Later on, I was hired specifically to come into various organizations. In the 2000s, I had a whole conflict resolution practice, consulting practice.
And you were the founding chair of the Violence Prevention Committee for the American Society for Training and Development.
Yes.
What prompted you to start that, and what did that group do?
Yeah. Well, it was kind of at the beginning of the violence prevention movement, and there was an organization in Boston that was really in need of expanding their offering, amplifying it. So I thought, wouldn't it be great to take a group of trainers who already know how to do training and train them in the content of conflict resolution and violence prevention? So that's what we did. We pulled together a group of trainers and expanded those trainings.
And what is an example of something that you would do in violence prevention? How do, in that setting, people prevent violence?
At the time, you know, and this still works to some degree, is being able to de-escalate conflicts. This is part of what the interrupters are doing and why people are wanting to fund violence prevention projects even now and train police in how to prevent and de-escalate conflict. You know, being able to really meet people where they are, mirror their upset, you know, be able to acknowledge what's going on for them, ask them if they would be willing to come and sit and talk, you know, being able to talk somebody down from a really violent, intense response is just kind of 101 for most conflict resolution work, including violence prevention.
Yeah, for sure. Let's move on to the Compassionate Listening Project.
It was started by a Jewish woman, actually, who was studying in the Mideast, and she was studying in Israel and Palestine, and she spent all of her weekend time going around the territories and going and listening to people from all sides of the conflict, and came back and started, I'm giving the very short version, but started the Compassionate Listening Project. And she ended up taking groups of people to Israel and Palestine to listen to people. That was the original idea, was just to compassionately listen to people who were experienced from all walks of life. There were people from Hamas, and there were people from, you know, the settlements, and everybody in between. And I ended up being one of the lead trainers in that organization. I ended up being president of the board of that organization. And basically what we were doing was really trying to help resolve the conflict by offering conflict resolution, first offering ourselves, that was the initial offering ourselves as compassionate listeners. And people would often just, almost always, just get kind of clear and released. You know what good listening can do, right? And it just kind of helped bring the temperature down. And then we started doing trainings there. And that's what I was really passionate about, was doing the training. And so we did that during the Second Intifada. We would bring groups of Israelis and Palestinians together.
At least 20 people died in Israel last night when a Palestinian suicide bomber blew up a bus in West Jerusalem. More than 100 people were injured. The New York Times described it as one of the deadliest attacks since the Second Intifada began 3 years ago.
Paint a picture of what was happening in the Second Intifada while you were doing this.
Well, it was terribly scary. You know, there had Israelis and Palestinians had come close to an agreement, and that agreement fell apart.
After 14 days of intensive negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians, I have concluded with regret that they will not be able to reach an agreement at this time.
Clinton was trying to negotiate a final agreement. Arafat wouldn't sign it. Some people say for good reasons, some people say for bad reasons, but whatever, he did not sign it and ended up calling for violence. Some people put that on Sharon. He walked up to the Temple Mount, which is sacred ground for Muslims, as the matchstick that started it.
And therefore, I'm sure that the sovereignty over the Temple Mount, it's in our hands now. It will be in our hands in the future. That will be the future.
Other people say that Arafat started it. Other people say that Arafat was calling for that because he thought he could get a better deal if he threatened violence. So what happened was just an explosion of rage and suicide bombings that were going on continually. I mean, there was one weekend when we were there where four suicide bombings happened. Israel went into Jenin and tried to really clear, like just similar to the war in Gaza right now, tried to really clear out a lot of the refugee camps where there was a lot of festering rage. So it was very violent. It was scary. And it also felt like this is the time. You know, I even got up from sitting Shiva, the 7 days of mourning after my younger brother passed away. And I got up and I went to Israel and Palestinian territories when suicide bombings were occurring regularly to teach dialogue skills to Israelis and Palestinians. I was such a true believer in the healing capacity of conflict resolution tools. The people that came were self-selected, so they were already inclined to want to build bridges. But we had, you know, Palestinian mediators and Israeli therapists and people who were political activists, and you know, it was a wide range, but there was real hope that we could really crack through this and create a new culture.
Yeah. Right. It sounds like the interpretation that you and others at the Compassionate Listening Project had is because the violence is so fierce and scary, that makes our work, your work at the time, even more important.
Absolutely. More important, and also a real belief in the breakthrough, that this was absolutely doable, that, you know, that I don't think I realized, nor did the rest of us realize, just how deeply entrenched these old stories and the rage would be, nor that it would be 20 some years that would dig in after all this happened. It would push the politics in very much more polarized directions. But yeah, at the time, oh, absolutely, totally hopeful, totally believed that we were going to change the Middle East. We stayed really focused on what people were experiencing and what their undergirding values were. And that actually brought together and built common ground around the humanity, which was ultimately not enough, but seemed like a really important place to start. I used to call it that we were, you know, say that we were tilling the soil for something new to grow. And in order to do that, you had to really be able to see that other person as, or those other people as human beings.
Yeah. Let's move on to Project Reconnections, which happened in the Bay Area. Tell me about the initiation of that project.
Yeah. Well, first of all, after I spent like 4 years working with the Israeli-Palestinian stuff, I was actually leaving Seattle. The Compassionate Listening Project is housed outside of Seattle on Bainbridge Island. I was driving down and I literally got this download, like, I need to work with the Jewish community. I didn't know how I was going to do that, but I found one of my compassionate listening partners who lived in the Bay Area, and we created the first ever compassionate listening session just for the Jewish community.
Yes. Now, some people listening might wonder, why would you need to facilitate something like this within the Jewish community? So could you talk about what was happening inside the Bay Area Jewish community around Israel?
Yes, I'd be happy to. And I have to laugh because anybody who knows the Jewish community knows, like, you know, the old joke, two Jews, three opinions. So we do have a long history of debate. And this issue had become very polarizing, where it once was so that Israel had become the unifying factor. It no longer was. And I mean, it still is to some degree, but much less than it was. There were a lot of people who were challenging the, what they were calling the occupation of the West Bank. And there were a lot of people who were just hunkering down and wanting to protect the Jewish community in Israel. So there was some splintering that was already going on. I was connected to people in both camps very strongly. And I knew there were good people who really cared about the Jewish community, who cared about Israel, and wanted to bring them together. And we ended up doing that. And it was an amazingly effective project where people who would not speak to each other, who would not walk in the same room, ended up becoming very close friends, challenging each other in how they saw things, challenging each other in, you know, I remember one person who was a really strong leftist activist, yet had never been to Israel. She was challenged to go, and she went. And somebody who had been doing in the mainstream Jewish community, who worked all over Israel, went to the settlements all the time, and had never been seen the Palestinian side of the occupation, and was just totally shattered by it.
And what was the scope across, who was involved across the Bay Area?
Well, we had about 1,000 people who directly went through our programs. But it was a very igniting thing. Even people who didn't directly experience it felt it, because rabbis were giving different kinds of sermons from the Bima. They were talking about the need for civil discourse and the need to bridge. We had discussions at the Jewish Film Festival. We had people who went through, there were six institutions that went through an entire year of dialogue process that I facilitated. We had people who just did not believe that it was even possible. People who had been anti-occupation activists and had been, felt like they'd been shut out of the mainstream Jewish community, connecting with people who had been shutting them out and didn't want to hear from them, or were calling them self-hating Jews. All that stopped. There was a whole different way of engaging that came out of that.
So throughout all, there's this thread that if there's conflict, let's find nonviolent methods, whether it's between Palestinians and Israeli Jews, whether it's within the American Jewish community, whether it's within corporate America, you name it, that's the way to do, and that's going to work most of the time, or that's the best shot.
Couples, families, all of it. That there was, I just saw such a lack of capacity for people to turn toward each other when they were going through conflict, and to really be able to develop the skills to be able to engage. And that I saw that as the entire thing.
During this period, when Rachel Aaron was doing nonviolence work in all of these different settings, she became aware of something that caused her, for the first time, to question whether nonviolence was the best approach in every situation of conflict. It was the civil war in Sierra Leone.
It began when rebels of the Revolutionary United Front attacked the east of Sierra Leone in 1991 on the border with Liberia, an insurrection against the power base of President Joseph Saidu Momo. The horror of what was to come, unimaginable at that stage. It launched a chain of violence, of coup d'etat and the involvement of foreign forces, officially or unofficially.
No matter how much trauma work I do, it's so traumatizing to see rampaging mobs. And that was happening.
In impossible to really say how many people died. Quoted figures ranging from 50 right up to 200,000 people killed, with many rapes, mutilations, and the forced use of child soldiers in both rebel and the regular armies.
So I'd be reading about this stuff, and the RUF was literally going through villages and lining up young kids and chopping the hands off of them. Like, that was their way of terrorizing. And it was just made me crazy.
There's something about the savagery, deliberate infliction of pain that was even different from the terrorist bombings. It feels different. That's bombing that results in death, it feels different when they're chopping off hands.
Right. It's intimate. It's up close. It's trench warfare and it's trench warfare against civilians who are unarmed. This was not to trench warfare armies like World War I, which is grotesque and tragic enough. This was civilians who were unarmed, in many cases, children.
Right.
So, you know, it was just heartbreaking. You know, I think part of what's kept me going all these years is a belief that we will work our way through all this. I really believe that we are evolving as a species despite, you know, downturns, and that we are going to keep moving up, you know, into higher levels of ways of dealing with each other. And that was such a brutal, regressive force. And it did recall all of the traumas of, you know, centuries.
This feeling of heartbreak that Rachel Aaron experienced around the massacre in Sierra Leone stayed with her for the next couple decades, as did the question it raised in her mind: is nonviolence always the most effective approach? Then, October 7th, 2023 happened.
Israel says it is at war after the Palestinian group Hamas launched an unprecedented attack on its territory. In an early morning assault, the militant group infiltrated Israel's southern border from Gaza using motorbikes, paragliders, and boats, launching thousands of rockets.
Over 1,200 people were really slaughtered. You know, some of the greatest peaceniks in Israel were killed, raped, mutilated, young people at a rave concert. And then the aftermath, what happened before Israel even set off one bomb in retaliation, the Free Palestine messages were appearing, professors were gloating, people were on the street in a way that was really denouncing Israel as if they had caused this. And that was not totally surprising because I live in the Bay Area and I've been involved in this particular conversation for a long time. But the amount of animosity and the numbers of people were really mortifying to me.
Yeah. So how did that affect you?
Well, I felt very righteously indignant. I felt as righteous that that was wrong as I one time felt righteous that conflict resolution skills were a higher, better, wiser, deeper way to go. So I know the Israel story really well. I grew up with it. And even some of my Jewish colleagues were out, you know, saying that Israel was committing genocide. And so it shocked me, pained me, but mostly my response was to kind of rise to a kind of a get on my moral high horse in a particular way. Mm. Yeah.
What happened next?
Well, I ended up in many, many conversations and all over social media using what I've come to call dialogic advocacy. So I still used my conflict resolution skills. I wasn't calling anybody names. I wasn't demeaning them. You know, I was like using my skills. But I was really pressing back on the narrative, which I found so full of historical untruths and distortions that I just kept confronting it everywhere I could. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the things that happened next. And also I wasn't sleeping very well. I was waking up in the middle of the night checking my phone to the point where even Facebook had a little message to me and said, "You're spending a lot of time in the middle of the night on Facebook. Do you need therapy? Do you need to call a friend?"
Wow.
First time that's ever happened. So I was pretty wound up,
yeah,
I'd say, for the first 2 months. Yeah.
I wondered how this influenced her view of nonviolence.
Yeah, I think it is part of it. You know, actually, an idea came through me very early on that would be for a global peace initiative that I actually wrote to Beebe and tried to get it through different sources to him, because I think he's the only person that could do it. And barring that, and so far that hasn't happened, barring something that large of scale, the only thing I think that's going to actually work is to actually get rid of Hamas's infrastructure. I know you can't get rid of an ideology, but you can certainly collapse an infrastructure. We've done it with ISIS, and you know, they still have some capacity. So I've not been out calling for a ceasefire. I have not been one of those people. In fact, I think it's unfair to Israel. I think if people were calling for Hamas to surrender, I could get behind that. I'm sad watching what's happening in Gaza. It's heartbreaking seeing people crawling through the rubble trying to find their children. And I don't know anybody who would put up with that next door to them without wanting some interference from those violent neighbors. And so, yeah, I would say so. I became more comfortable.
Rachel Aaron's experience after October 7th brought back memories of the RUF in Sierra Leone chopping off the hands of entire towns of young boys.
And I was crazed by that. And I really did a lot of inner work. And I thought, what would I do? And I thought, if I had a gun, you bet I would like take one of those guys out. And then I would go run and hold them while they were dying. But I was unquestionably like, I could use violence to stop worse violence. And I later saw Ken Wilber's wonderful quote.
Ken Wilber is an American philosopher who has deeply influenced both Rachel Aaron and me.
Sometimes violence in saner hands can prevent worse violence. And that's kind of been a mantra for me right now. I don't equate Israel in Gaza with Hamas.
That's a profound vision of shooting someone and then holding them while they're suffering.
And it's easy to say from almost 10,000 miles away, right? Like that I can support this. I'm not there. I'm not on the ground. I'm not having to do that shooting. But I have not felt once that I wanted to call for a ceasefire.
Right. What I'm getting is this combination of care for the human beings involved and realization that sometimes hurting human beings saves more lives and reduces suffering overall.
Yes, which I guess should not be new since it's kind of a historical truth, but yeah, it became very visceral and real to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you.
How do you hold nonviolent solutions now?
Well, it's interesting. I'm really wrestling with it because there are a lot of people right now who are reminding me of where I was back in, you know, the early 2000s, and they're very passionate about nonviolent solutions. I just listened to a webinar last night with a rabbi who's really promoting that idea. And I listen with kind of sadness and skepticism and hope, and it's just a mix of emotion, because I do think that in many cases, you can resolve a lot of things. I think Israelis and Palestinians have missed many opportunities to resolve things nonviolently over decades. And it doesn't always work. Things can be too far gone, too entrenched, there's just too much trauma, too much rage to manage. And so sometimes violence is, I believe, sadly necessary.
It's almost like 95% of the time, to throw out a number, nonviolent solutions work. They're important. You're committed to them. And the people who are pressing you, why not nonviolence? Why not nonviolence? Why are talking about the 5%? Maybe it's 20%. Maybe it's 40%. Yeah. But that percentage that you say violence is necessary here, they're saying nonviolence is always necessary. And you're saying, no, there's an exception. but you're not letting go of nonviolence for many other situations.
Oh my God, no. And in my deepest being, you know, I still envision being in Gaza and sitting down with Hamas and you know, Israelis and bringing them together. Like, it's just so core to my being. And then there's this other layer that is sort of grown over me that feels like a defensive layer that just says, that's just not going to work. And it's very hard to wrap my mind around it intellectually. I can easily grasp it emotionally and at a level of identity. It's very challenging because everything in me is going like, am I missing something? Did I not mirror correctly? Did something happen? Like, you know, I'm still trying to find a way to hold a completely nonviolent stand. And I can't see it right now. Mm-hmm. So it may be my limitation. It may be a limitation of the tool.
Okay. Is there anything else you want to say that you haven't yet?
Well, I think you could probably hear the grief and anguish that's underneath what I'm saying. And it's true because I feel like, you know, humanity is at a real turning point, not just the Middle East, but there are a lot of places, including, you know, in the U.S., that with a lot of violence erupting on the streets. There's a lot of political violence. I really hope we can turn this. And there are a lot of people working on it and a lot of good people who are making good connections and trying to build those bridges and trying to heal forward. And I hope and pray we can.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Reflections. Let's talk for a moment about what we can learn from Rachel Aaron and the story she shares. First, if we take Rachel Aaron's story seriously, we might reconsider a famous saying that I personally have subscribed to for a long time. Violence begets more violence. I think we can all agree this pretty much is true. Yet, what it doesn't address is a different question. What does nonviolence beget? Are there circumstances in which, in response to violence, nonviolence actually produces more suffering, more harm, more brutality, and more death? Second, I want you to notice the particular circumstances that prompted Rachel Aaron to reconsider her view. It wasn't war. War has existed for Rachel Aaron's entire life. In fact, as she shares with us, it was in the midst of the bloody Second Intifada that she traveled to Israel and to the Palestinian territories to mediate, to facilitate conversations between Israelis and Palestinians, right in the middle of that bloody conflict. So war and violence alone did not change her view. Instead, it was a particular type of violence, a savagery, a brutality of the type that she witnessed with Sierra Leone, chopping off the hands of entire towns of little children, and October 7th with the extraordinary barbarism that Hamas inflicted upon Israelis. These were specific types of violence, brutal, savage, seemingly inhuman, and yet they were very, very human. It might lead us to wonder, what kinds of people would do this? What motivates them? What will they respond to? And what won't they respond to? Maybe, just maybe, if someone is motivated by a desire purely to inflict suffering on others and have no capacity for compassion, have no ability to observe rules or the law, and in fact, we might argue, are dominated by a worldview that is actually pre-modern. And this is true, by the way, not just of Hamas, not just of the people in Sierra Leone. This worldview is true and exists in the United States, in Israel, in Europe, in Asia, in Africa, in South America. It's not about an ethnicity. It's not about a culture. It's a worldview. It's a container that is occupied by many different cultures and ethnicities. Got that? So what's important here is that when somebody with that worldview, who can be that brutal, is inflicting violence, maybe nonviolence actually encourages them to do more and produces more suffering. And so that's what, in this instance, seems to have motivated Rachel Aaron. Third, Rachel here is talking about when force is necessary. She's not talking about the limits of force. She's not asking us to consider how much force is enough, how much is too much. She's not assessing the Netanyahu-Israeli government's response to October 7th. That's not the question here. And that's not why I invited her onto the show. It's simply to raise the question of whether nonviolence is always and in every situation the best response to conflict. Fourth, I think all of you listeners are way too smart and savvy and grounded to do this, but I want to mention this anyways. The lesson of this story is not to respond to conflict in your lives by using force. If you are having tension with your significant other, with your kids, with your coworkers, I can tell you that 99 times out of 100, verbal violence and certainly physical violence is going to make things worse. So the lesson of Rachel Aaron's entire life is that most of the time, we need to slow down, take a deep breath, get grounded, consider what we stand for, respond with respect and dignity and slowly and with nonviolence. Finally, I want to acknowledge that this topic, this war, is emotionally wrenching. It's affected you. It's affected me. It's affected all of the folks in Israel and in Gaza, in the Middle East, and around the world. Let's actually take some guidance from Rachel Aaron here. So even in the midst of talking about when force is necessary, she describes her grief. She describes her anguish. She alludes to the very deep wrestling that she has been doing for decades around the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians, and the wrestling that she, you, and I are doing around this current war. So in the midst of this wrenching time, let's all be kind to ourselves. Let's be kind to the people around each other, even when we see things very differently. Thanks for listening. If you believe in this show, like what you're hearing, or simply don't know what to do with yourself for the next 60 seconds, please subscribe to this podcast and leave me a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. This show is produced in Detroit by Zach Rosen.